What's new, Pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa. What's new, Pussycat? Whoa, 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 whoa.
He really did it, folks. He really did it. You know, I was in San Francisco when Donald Trump got shot in the ear, and I was at dinner with some friends and family, actually, and they got mad at me for saying that Donald Trump was a man of destiny. I'm not saying I like the guy, actually quite the contrary, but it does kind of seem like he's been put here at this particular moment in time. It's yet to be seen exactly what the history books will say about him, but it seems likely he'll be a main character, if not the main character, when it comes to this political moment. So welcome back, as always, to the New Yorker political scene. It's nice to have you here today as the dust settles on this election and a new fight emerges over the narrative of why Kamala Harris and the Democrats managed to lose to someone like Donald Trump. That's mostly what we'll be getting into today, listening to how the hosts of the New Yorker political scene, who are joined this week by their daddy, New Yorker's editor-in-chief David Remnick, for this very solemn occasion. Now, if you remember all the way back to last week before the election, Jane Mayer, Susan Glasser, and Evan Osnos were pontificating about how history might remember this moment in American life. They hypothesized that if Harris won, it would mean that history would remember this as a moment when America said no to right-wing authoritarianism and said yes to democratic principles and values. In that scenario, Donald Trump would be remembered as an aberration, a black mark in an otherwise exceptional nation and people. And if Trump won, well, that would mean that America has chosen fascism, darkness over light, ignorance and anger over enlightenment and hope. In that scenario, Donald Trump is not an aberration, but actually a reflection of our true nature. This would represent the death knell of American exceptionalism. Or at least so I had hoped. But wouldn't you know it, these guys have completely dropped that framework. I had hoped that at least for once, these three would have to grapple with the fact that the America they fantasize about has either died or never existed, and that they have been living in Trump's America this whole time. No such luck, though. But anyway, let's dive into their analysis, which is mostly a diagnosis of why the Harris campaign failed.
The anti-incumbency gene is something that is very present here in the United States and around the world.
It's global,
right now.
Isn't it? That,
exactly.
Yeah. And it's an anti-incumbency feeling that seems directed specifically at cost of living, a sense of deep inequality. I think if we ascribe everything to the craziness of Donald Trump, we make a profound mistake. I think for a lot of voters, it's despite the craziness, despite all the antics we can point to.
This isn't a bad point, I think. COVID was such a bizarre and dramatic time. I don't think we fully reckoned with how it changed our lives and the way we think about the world and about government. So many problems that had long existed were exacerbated and laid bare. We saw the failings of our healthcare system, which isn't even a system so much as a marketplace, trying to figure out where to get a COVID test or where and when to be vaccinated. Remember all that? Not to mention the hundreds of millions of our dollars that was siphoned off by pharmaceutical companies who profited off of the vaccines. We were made acutely aware of just how precarious life was for so many people in this country who were just praying not to get sick at their frontline jobs because they didn't have paid sick leave. Lots of those workers were making and continue to make below a living wage. People had to move back in with family. People lost their jobs. It was a really fucked up time. And despite a lot of talk and a hopeful moment where it seemed like Bernie Sanders might win the Democratic nomination, almost none of those problems I just mentioned have been systematically addressed. Yes, the Biden administration passed legislation helping people and businesses with one-time payments. But if you look at what Roosevelt was able to accomplish after the Great Depression, the New Deal, which universally established programs that remain popular to this day, Medicare and Social Security, the Biden administration really fell short of the moment. Did he inherit a universally problematic political moment as an incumbent post-COVID? Yes, he did. But he also squandered a once-in-a-generation opportunity to really fix some of the profound problems with our country and its economy.
Then the obvious question, Evan, to you, who's written a book about American inequality and spent a lot of time all over the country to report that book, why couldn't first Joe Biden and then Kamala Harris in the 100 days that was left to her to campaign, why could she not get her arms around that central issue? And why was it such a losing issue for the Democrats?
I am ashamed to admit, my dear listener, that I was completely unaware that in 2022, our very own Evan Osnos published a book on inequality titled Wildland, The Making of America's Fury. It makes a little bit of sense when you consider that Osnos has basically spent between 2020 and now shilling for his biography of Joe Biden and has positioned himself both at The New Yorker and at CNN, where we work together, as the in-house Bidenologist. Now, what's interesting is I, who has paid a lot of attention to Osnos's political analysis over the past 4+ years, hasn't really heard him talk about inequality as an underlying factor in our political moment. You're much more likely to hear him analyzing someone like Joe Biden or Kamala Harris as a character in our national myth. But I'm taking note here of this book, and I'm going to look into it more because I'm really curious what might be in there.
Yeah, you have to start with the fact that in a way that people don't articulate every day, but on some level they know, if you were a kid born in this country in 1940, you stood a 90% chance of out-earning your parents. That number has fallen in half. And it runs through everything that people encounter, whether you're the young man or young woman, or you're a person of color, or you're a white person. It is a defining fact of your existence. And of course, the Democratic Party's self-image is that it has an almost self-evident claim on speaking to those frustrations, on those issues. And in some ways, it evaporated in a period of time before the Democrats could fully acknowledge that they were losing their grip on it.
That is a fascinating statistic Osnos just gave there. If you are 80 years old right now, there was a 90% chance that you fared better economically than your parents did. Now that number has been cut in half, meaning most of us aren't going to do as well as our parents did economically. Now, I think it's funny that Osnos is mentioning all of this and his book about inequality that nobody's heard of, just as his two cash cows, Joe Biden and now Kamala Harris, are exiting stage right. He is a survivor, folks, and if it means picking up the mantle of working class struggle to stay relevant, maybe he's here for that too. Time will tell, I guess. But listen to this. Listen to how Osnos has rewritten his hagiography of Joe Biden. What had been Biden's virtuous worldview is now his fatal flaw.
You know, I was thinking about it today because he gave a short speech at the Rose Garden in which he said he kind of used his central mantra, the thing that has explained his life, which is, you know, when you get knocked down, you get back up. And I heard it today and it had the echo of catastrophe about it because it was that mantra that inspired him to run for the second term and then to stay in despite people and despite the polls and despite other Democrats saying, you've got to get out, you've got to get out. It was almost like he made himself unavailable to hear what the universe was saying.
Evan, how you've changed.
The Democratic Party in this election lost ground with constituency groups like Latino voters and young voters. What is your sense of how the party, after its period of mourning, is going to come to terms with this reckoning? And do party officials even see it as a reckoning?
You know, it's early days here. They surely will convene some sort of great summits and talk to each other and create a circular firing line. I don't know what they will come up with here. I would hope that they would consider how the money picture has corrupted both parties. I mean, I think it's very hard for the Democrats to be the champions of the working people when the election looks like a battle between billionaires, ours versus theirs, and the consulting class is getting rich and working for corporations in between the elections. It's very hard to keep the line close to the working voters that used to be the base of the party.
Okay, Comrade Jane, let's fucking go. It's obviously imperative that Democrats have this discussion about class and inequality. I'm not going to cite you all of the exit polling that shows how most voters said the economy was the most important issue that informed their vote, or how little economic proposals there were in the Harris campaign platform. Yes, there were a few specific things around the edges, but nothing as substantial and simple as, say, an increase in the minimum wage, just to give an example of something that was a part of Joe Biden's winning platform in 2020. Since the election, Bernie Sanders has been saying rightfully that the Democratic Party has turned its back on the working class. Now, he's not wrong, but if he really does think that, I'm not sure he should have lent his credibility to Joe Biden and then to Kamala Harris. But putting that aside for a second, let's look at some of what he's proposed that Democrats could embrace going forward. Because Sanders isn't just making some vague theory for the case of economic populism, he's got some specific items here that I think Democrats ignore at their own peril. These are from Bernie Sanders' Boston Globe op-ed published after the election. End Citizens United, which allows for unlimited money to be spent on political campaigns. Raise the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $17 an hour. He had previously said $15 an hour, but I think he's correcting for inflation there. Pass the Right to Organize Act to make it easier for workers to unionize. Increase Social Security benefits for seniors and pay for it by increasing the cap on taxable income, basically meaning rich people would pay more taxes that would go to funding Social Security. Guarantee health care to everyone in this country, beginning with the expansion of Medicare to cover home health care, dental, hearing, and vision. Cut prescription drug prices in half. Provide all workers with paid medical and family leave. Equal pay for equal work, meaning women cannot be paid less than men for doing the same job. Build 3 million units of affordable housing. Make public colleges and universities tuition free. Reduce fraud, abuse, and waste at the Pentagon, meaning basically shrinking the military's budget. So yeah, I'd love to hear Democrats answer why they don't support those specific policy proposals, but instead, we get slop like this from Nancy Pelosi, who's asked about Bernie Sanders' comments that the Democratic Party has turned its back on the working class.
Well, I just completely disagree. And in fact, might notice that Kamala Harris ran ahead of Bernie Sanders in Vermont.
So what does that tell you? I mean,
it tells you that the fact is that what we do, what our purpose is in the Democratic Party, is for America's working families.
So
since you pursue it, what? Go ask Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders has not won. Let me, with all due respect, and I have a great deal of respect for him, for what he stands for, but I don't respect him saying that the Democratic Party has abandoned the working class families. That's where we are. For example, under President Biden, you see the rescue package, money in the pockets of people, shots in the arm, children in school safely, working people back to work. What did Trump do when he was president? One bill that gave a tax cut to the richest people in America. In fact,
why did voters who earned less than $100,000 go for Trump in such large numbers?
Well, there are cultural issues involved in elections as well. Guns, gods, and gays. That's the way they say it.
Guns, gods, and gays? What? What is this, 1994? What is she even talking about? Guns was basically a non-issue in this election. I know this is some sort of catchphrase she was probably using 40 years ago, but still, guns? Not a thing this year. God? I guess maybe you can say that abortion is an issue that divides the believers from the non-believers. So okay, let's give her that one. God this year played out over abortion. But guess what? The Democratic Party was on the winning side of that issue. Everyone, especially women up and down the income bracket, support a woman's right to choose, so she has 0 point there. And gays, I don't really see how gay people were up for debate in this election, but if we're being generous, maybe we can let that mean trans people, which did seem to play a role in the election, though I think it's still unclear how exactly. But regardless, is this the sort of explanation you want to hear from a major power broker in Democratic politics in the year of our Lord 2024? I know Pelosi isn't the House leader anymore, but listen to her anger at the mere idea that the working class would be upset with Democrats. Listen to how she dismisses any criticism from someone who, so many young people in particular, see as the moral center of the Democratic Party. And then listen to how she points to these Biden accomplishments. Some of them, like the infrastructure bill, were good, sure. But like, this is the type of person and the type of critical thinking that's going on in the upper echelons of the party. Pelosi also said she thinks Biden should have dropped out sooner and that not doing so probably hurt Harris. And that's a conversation I am all for having, but only if it's going to go all the way in critiquing the people around Biden who defended and fortified his absurd decision to run for re-election. If one positive thing comes out of this whole mess, maybe, somehow I doubt it, but just maybe, the Democratic Party will have a reckoning with the way it operates and makes decisions. And for fuck's sake, can we clean house and get all these geriatrics in charge and their enablers the fuck out of there? Evan Osnos, what says you?
I think that it is a very simple fact that, as we started this conversation talking about, a lot of Americans decided fundamentally that Republicans are more interested in their economic hardship, and they wanted to listen to that, as radical and offensive as it was in many cases.
And you know the left's reply to that, and you're seeing that pop up again,
right,
is Bernie Sanders would have been the answer, that a principled left-leaning economic populism would have been the way to beat Donald Trump.
I certainly think that at this point, the argument that the Democratic Party, as personified by Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and this vast and in many ways incoherent coalition that had to address a equal number of issues on equal terms, clearly did fall short on the number one issue, which was economics. You know, somebody, a Democrat, said to me last night, and rings true to me, which is that people value their identity as consumers as much as they value their identity as workers, meaning that if you've lost the ability to consume in the way that defines you, then you begin to treat that as a grievance.
I just love this line because Evan Osnos just walks right up to the precipice of postmodern Marxist critique, where he's seemingly contemplating how life under capitalism has workers failing to identify themselves as belonging to a class, but rather sees themselves as consumers. But instead of making the point that this is a bad thing because it diminishes our revolutionary potential, Osnos just takes it as a truth with neutral value. Like, yeah, our ability to buy things or not to be able to buy things becomes a grievance, Evan. It sure does. But it's also related to our condition as workers, because it's the way we're compensated for our work that ultimately determines our position in the market, right? I mean, assuming we are people who live off of the income we make from work and not from being owners of income-producing assets. Anyway, I just think it's funny that Osnos is teetering on the verge of being in dialogue with the Frankfurt School, seemingly without even knowing it. You'd think someone who lived and worked in communist China would... Anyway, maybe it's just better this way.
You know, Democrats are still in such denial. You know, that is, as Jane said, you know, going to be a huge process. But, you know, the most organized group inside the Democratic Party, right, is this progressive left. They had Biden, you know, who presents as a sort of centrist guy, but actually in a lot of ways in the personnel, in many of the individual policies of this administration, it was a very hard left group.
Citations needed here, Susan.
One of the aspects that we haven't talked about at all, but I do think, you know, helped to power this was Donald Trump and his party's effective use of culture war issues to pry away independent voters who otherwise were open to voting for Democrats. And I don't see, you know, that with our media bubbles the way that they are, I see the organized effort by the progressive left minority in the Democratic Party is already kicking in gear. You have Bernie Sanders kind of blaming centrism, a lot of his allies already doing that. I don't see any kind of willingness to say, like, well, let's talk about that transgender ad, or, you know, why is it that so many Americans were open to the kind of manipulation and fear and panic of this idea that there's going to be boys playing girls' sports? I mean, that was probably one of the biggest applause lines after mass deportation now, both at the Republican convention, at the Madison Square Garden rally that you attended as well as I did,
right,
David.
Kamala Harris is for them, they.
Yeah.
Donald
it's
Trump
for
is
he.
For you.
Exactly. So in a narrow sense, I didn't see a lot of critical thinking or ability to look at, like, how did Democrats let Joe Biden declare for re-election, you know, when he was going to be 86 years old, and let that go on until the, you know, it just literally kicked them in the face this year. In the same way that right now, after this election, I just think the institutional party, you know, there'll be lots of loudness, but in the end, it's pulling in the extremes. And the Republicans, I think, are going to get more extreme to the right. And I think the Democrats are going to get more extreme to the left.
Okay. So on the one hand, it's refreshing to hear these three mull over the idea that the Democratic Party is sclerotic, out of touch, and has offered very little to the working class. And the voters have clearly reacted to that. But on the other hand, you have analysis like this from Susan Glasser, which is her default instinct, basically to say that Donald Trump is the extreme on the right, and now the extreme left of the Democratic Party is somehow going to be the mirror image of Trump, and that's what's wrong with American politics. This is like mainstream Washington punditry 101. The reasonable position is somewhere in the center, regardless of the evidence and what the voters are telling you. Luckily, we have Comrade Osnos to talk some sense into her.
There has to be a precise understanding of what we mean when we talk about the left of the Democratic Party, because it's not clear that Bernie Sanders is the same as the cultural progressive forces we were talking about a moment ago. And in fact, it may turn out that the Democratic Party is going to double down on a piece of it, on the economic message, and re-examine what it, how much
that,
and
that
how
he
it
represents.
Talks about. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. While thinking in new ways about how it talks about cultural issues.
I mean, and in fact, the part of the left that cares most about identity issues has often been at odds with Bernie Sanders because they don't see him. I mean, the Hillary crowd particularly did not see him as supportive of women. There are fissures within all of that.
I'm honestly kind of surprised, first of all, that Evan Osnos and Jane Mayer understand these concepts, but even more so that they're expressing them now here on this podcast. Things really have to get pretty bleak in the world if you have these three parsing out the differences between the identity politics left and the democratic socialist economic populist left. But you know what? Kudos to them. Also very fitting, though, that Jane Mayer brings it all back to Hillary Clinton. In a way, maybe what this election has shown us is that we're destined to just keep living 2016 over and over and over again.
But we really haven't talked about the other thing that seemed so different during this campaign, at least to me, is that the mainstream media, so-called legacy media, really has lost dominance in terms of the information ecosystem at this point.
Didn't we know that before this race?
We felt it going election by election. I would say this is the one where it was gone.
I mean, I don't think we're telling secrets out of school, Evan, when we reveal that even a magazine that endorsed, maybe because we endorsed Kamala Harris and is seen as somewhat liberal magazine, a liberal magazine, when attempting to interview Kamala Harris to get a little bit of her time,
yeah,
we got none of it for Evan's profile, whereas she was on every podcast in the world. I don't say that with any anger or resentment. Or,
well, she wasn't on our podcast.
Right. No, but it was. I think
damn
David's
right.
Point is,
yeah.
David's right.
Hey, don't feel bad, guys. I couldn't get Kamala Harris to come on my podcast either. It is interesting, though, that they're discussing how the mainstream media and their perch atop it has lost purchase over the past few years. It's almost like this podcast, the one you're listening to, has started to consume itself. Like when the snake eats its tail or whatever. Trippy shit, bro. Anyway, it reminded me of a moment from another podcast I hate listen to occasionally, The New York Times' Matter of Opinion, where liberal opinion columnist Carlos Losada nearly goes to blows with right-wing op-ed writer and human dingleberry Ross Douthat over this very issue. Check this shit out.
I would just say that I think there's a dynamic where, you know, you guys are talking about scapegoats and enemies, right? Obviously, scapegoat and enemy number one for Donald Trumpian populism is the media, institutions like the one that all three of us work for, right? Elite institutions of all kinds. But what that means, I think, is that people who are inside those institutions experience Trumpism more completely through the crazier things he says, the vitriolic things he says.
Like when he said that journalists should be shot?
Yes.
Like that part? He said that he wouldn't mind it so much if journalists were shot?
When he said that if somebody was going to assassinate him, it was good that they'd have to fire through the press. Yes. Like things like that.
Yeah,
yes.
And he said he didn't mind that so much.
There's maybe nothing I loathe more among the liberal pundit class than when they make themselves out to be the victims and protagonists of Donald Trump's political agenda. If you know anything about Donald Trump and the political consequences of Trumpism, you have to know that the people who are going to face the brunt of it are going to be undocumented immigrants, people protesting against Israel, trans people, and other marginalized groups. Donald Trump may spar with the media. Hell, he may even use his power to try to silence or destabilize media institutions. But let's not get our panties in a bunch that somehow we are going to be thrown up against the wall by Trumpist brown shirts. Anyway, I'm glad that this election has seemingly grounded Daddy Remnick and his seen children somewhat. Let's hear what they have to say about their role in the media in the forthcoming Trump administration.
Final question for all. The Political Scene is a show which, as you often say, is about the big questions in American politics. The return of Trump to the White House is the biggest one that we've seen in a long time. And now that it's happened, what questions do each of you have for this new Trump era? Why don't we begin with Evan and go around the table?
I think I'm interested in how institutions will protect people who need and deserve protection, meaning, to take a prime example, one of the biggest shames of the first Trump administration was the separation of families. And I think that at the border, and the prospect of something like that happening again is something that institutions, whether they are legal or journalistic or investigative in other ways, they deserve support because it is not going to be coming from within the House, meaning it is going to be harder and harder for dissidents within the departments, within agencies to come forward and say there's something terrible going on.
Okay, Evan, I like this anarcho-syndicalism I sense in you. They call him Antifa Evan, folks. I think that's a great beat for you, Evan. I hope Daddy Remnick sends you out to find those stories so we can break them down here on this podcast. I know I sound like I'm being sarcastic, guys, but I really mean it. We need more journalism about the stuff Evnos is talking about here, the non-government actors pushing back on the encroaching fascism. Hopefully the New Yorker can deliver on that. What say you, Jane?
I mean, I'm always preoccupied with abuses of power. I'm really interested in whether the rule of law can contain Trump and the people around him at this point. Are we going to continue to be sort of this exceptional country where it's a democracy with checks and balances, or are we going to see it tip over into strongman government where it's deeply corrupt? And I think it's going to take constant vigilance on the part of the press. And I just hope we have the energy and the ability to just keep holding these people in power accountable.
Sorry if it sounds different now. My radiator was making a loud hissing noise, so I've moved into the bathroom to record the rest of the podcast. Anyway, back to Jane's point. Are we going to continue to be this exceptional country or see this spill over into strongman government? Have you seen the news, Jane? Donald Trump is going to be the next president. I thought we agreed these questions would be answered by the election result. Are we humans or are we Dancer? We're Dancer, Jane. Dancer. I also love how she says she hopes we have the energy to keep holding these people accountable, as if they've done such a great job at that up until now. So much accountability these days, folks. They're calling it the age of accountability. How about this for accountability? Joe Biden is currently the president of the United States, and the deadline he set for Israel to allow more aid into northern Gaza has come and went. Maybe go ask the White House about it for starters.
Jane and Evan are right that it's really about, do we or do we not see Donald Trump implement the playbook for anti-democratic, authoritarian, strongman rule? And that will determine, I think, an answer to a question that's plagued us, which is Trump essentially an outlier, but still, you know, within the framework of American politics, or does he represent something like a rupture? And is this part of the natural oscillation of American politics? And in 2 years, will divided government return in the midterms, or will he go after the political enemies within? Will he attack the fake news media in a structural, legal way, for example, by throwing reporters out of the White House, simply refusing to obey the ethics, laws, and rules that have been put on the books over the last few decades? Will he weaponize the Justice Department? Will he transform the national security state and the intelligence apparatus of this country into his personal and political fiefdoms? Those are the questions, I think, that you could make the argument about, say, Vladimir Putin or Viktor Orban or Erdogan in their first term or their first or second terms in power, that you still didn't understand exactly which way that society was going. This is the pivotal 4 years. We're going to understand whether something like an American strongman can arise within our system right now or not.
Okay, so they're basically just punting on having to admit that we're Dancer. We're Dancer, goddammit. He's gonna do all the things, Susan. He's gonna do them. Putin, Orban, blah, blah, blah. It's happening, Susan. wake up and smell the McDonald's. Let's see if Daddy Remnick can inspire us in these dark times. Put our hairs on end. Make our little nipples hard like stones.
And I just add to that, to those excellent questions, what can we expect of ourselves? You know, having lived in a totalitarian country and seeing them come out of it and then plunge back into authoritarianism, it being Russia, we have to recognize that actual dissidence is very rare. That level of self-sacrifice that we've seen from Alexei Navalny or farther back in the past, Sakharov, Solzhenitsyn, and Evan knows all about this too, from China, is exceedingly rare. But ordinary citizens are capable of ordinary kinds of heroism. And I think, you know, at home here at this magazine and in the press, I think we have to demand of ourselves, and that's the vow I make to our readers and my colleagues, that we will insistently do it. And our duty, our primary duty, is to apply pressure on power truthfully, accurately, consistently, and fearlessly. And I hope we're equal to that challenge, and I hope our colleagues elsewhere are too, because it's essential.
Okay, so my nipples did get a little hard there. I think Remnick is right. God damn it, at least partly. He's right, as I said, that dissidents and protesters, people who put their asses on the line for what they believe in, even when it goes against the full weight of the American empire, those are the people who deserve our admiration and respect. Writing some articles for The New Yorker, it can be good. It's probably not going to be good most of the time, but maybe sometimes, especially if you're Isaac Chotiner, it will almost certainly be good. But I'm not sure how brave it is, really. Anyway, I know I do a lot of New Yorker bashing on this show, and I do it with love, because probably like most of you, I grew up reading The New Yorker, and I still do. Maybe over the past 10 years or so, I hate read it more than I read it, which is unfortunate because it really is rare for writers to be able to make a living and spend actual resources doing real reporting these days. So I wanted to point something out I've been sort of ignoring up until now, which is that The New Yorker political scene is a podcast feed, really, more than it is a show. And on that feed, you'll often hear a different show hosted by Tyler Foggett, which is also called The Political Scene. It's really dogshit branding, actually. But regardless, her show isn't bad. And if I had to guess, I'd say that Remnick knows that he has to empower and give a platform to younger writers, writers whose worldview wasn't shaped entirely by the Reagan years. Remnick probably knows that he can't just let The New Yorker's credibility and its audience go down with the sinking boomer ship. And so you sometimes will hear some pretty good and reasonable analysis from Tyler Foggett and the people she has on. It's a tiny glimmer of hope in an otherwise wretched sea of punditry. So I wanted to share some clips from that show with you as well for contrast. Here's Tyler talking to Claire Malone.
How do we write about this without invalidating the fact that more than half of the country wanted this? Because I think it's very easy to sort of talk about his racist and misogynistic rhetoric. But then it's like, what do you do when he has such a diverse group of voters voting for him? It doesn't mean that he's not racist, but it makes it a bit more complicated and harder to dismiss.
My first thought is you cover more of the root causes. So people saw this as an economic election, inflation, immigration as an economic issue. You have to go out and find stories that aren't just congressional budget stories that are about like, and not the kind of corny, like, I went to a diner in Reading, Pennsylvania. You have to go out and you have to say like, we need to find ways to cover the frankly like huge class divides in this country. This country is kind of having a class war. And I think that the media has to figure out compelling ways to cover that. I think for us in elite print media, and I think we should be very honest about where we stand and sort of the perch, like our stories are not being directly read by most of the country, if a fraction of the country. So I think places like The New Yorker, The New York Times, The Washington Post have to think about how do we cover those root causes of dissatisfaction? How do you cover that class war, for lack of a better phrase? And you need to find ways where the work of journalism is actually reaching people's lives, and you need to know how your reporting will filter down through the media ecosystem. And you need to think about that when you choose stories if you want to have a civic impact on American life.
And here's some insight from Jay Caspian Kang.
I think that part of the problem here is the death of local media. I think that it used to be that you could pull somebody from one of these communities or one of these places and have them write on a national level, or have, you know, people read what they were doing, and that they would have a firm grasp of what these populations were thinking because they lived amongst them, right? Now we have a media ecosystem where a lot of the people who come in are very young. They come from Ivy League schools, and that, you know, they're sort of theorizing, or they go to a place for a short period of time and they get an assessment of it, or they check with five different experts, none of whom really know what they're talking about, but work at fancy colleges. And then they come to some sort of consensus that type of way. I don't think that that type of stuff works particularly well, but I don't think that we're doing quite as bad of a job, I think, as some of our critics would say, right? I think that, for example, I do think there was tons of reporting about shifts in Latino voting in all sorts of outlets, and they're just ignored.
So maybe there are people with brains worth their weight in salt over there at The New Yorker after all. Let's hope that as the Democratic Party eats itself, that economic populism wins that fight, and also that Tyler Foggett and her crew have more protagonism on the New Yorker Political Scene's podcast feed. And a bit of news from me here. I will be taking a bit of a break from this podcast for a few weeks. I have some travel lined up related to the film I'm making, so I'll be pretty busy with that for the next month or so. But please don't do anything crazy like unsubscribing from this podcast. I'm sort of considering this the end of the first season of the show, and I plan to be back maybe around Christmas or in the new year at the latest with some more episodes for you. So until then, stay frosty and stay sane. I love you all so much.